Wisconsin, and stay tuned for a public affairs show.
Hello, this is Kathy Clugston with the BBC News. In an address to the United Nations, President Hassan Rouhani of Iran has bitterly condemned President Trump's criticism of his country. Mr. Rouhani said Mr. Trump's attack in an earlier speech at the UN had been ignorant, absurd and hateful. He said his people wouldn't be intimidated by threats.
We never threaten anyone, but we do not tolerate threats from anyone.
نمیپذیریم
زبان ما زبان کرامت است و زبان تهدید را بر نمیتابیم ما اهل مذاکره ایم اما از موضع برابر و احترام متقابل.
Mr. Trump had called Iran a corrupt dictatorship that spread violence. He was also scathingly critical of the deal under which Tehran agreed with the world powers that it would curb its nuclear program. Spain's Interior Ministry says police have seized nearly 10 million ballot papers in Barcelona as part of the Spanish government's efforts to stop Catalonia's independence referendum next month. Catalonia's leader, Carles Puigdemont, accused Madrid of being repressive, intimidating and totalitarian, saying it had, in effect, imposed a state of emergency. Guy Hedgeco reports.
There were angry demonstrations across Catalonia following the raids, which saw members of the civil guard enter several premises belonging to the regional government. 14 Catalan officials were arrested. This is the most dramatic development so far in the Spanish government's efforts to thwart the referendum planned for the 1st of October. Catalonia's nationalist premier, Carles Puigdemont, said the central government was acting outside the law and insisted the referendum would still take place.
Emergency crews and volunteers have been digging through rubble with their bare hands in search of trapped survivors after a powerful earthquake struck central Mexico on Tuesday, killing more than 200 people. Dozens of buildings have collapsed, including a school where at least 21 children were killed. Precia Arafin Cabo is there with UNICEF.
Many children were traumatized from this earthquake because it happened really quickly and the response was not that quick. There are at least 5 million children living in these affected municipalities and within Mexico City. These children really need life-saving support in terms of water and sanitation.
The United Nations has a record 29 member states, including China, Iran and Saudi Arabia, have retaliated against citizens who cooperate with the UN on human rights activities. In a report presented to the UN's Human Rights Council, a senior official said 11 of the states named are council members. He said there were cases of individuals who've been abducted and physically and sexually abused. World News from the BBC. Another uncle of a 10-year-old rape victim in India has been arrested on suspicion of assaulting her. Police said he was the younger brother of the man arrested earlier who had been charged with raping the girl. The child gave birth to a baby girl who's receiving emergency care. The police began looking for a second suspect after forensic tests revealed the baby's DNA samples did not match those of the first suspect. The case has sparked widespread debate and revulsion in India. The manager of England's women's football team, Mark Sampson, who's been embroiled in allegations of racism and bullying, is about to step down. Sampson was earlier accused by one of his players, the striker Eniola Aluko, of making discriminatory remarks. He's denied those allegations and has been cleared of wrongdoing by two separate investigations. The BBC understands that Sampson's departure relates to fresh accusations relating to a previous role some years ago. A leopard has been discovered in a wildlife reserve in northern Nigeria, decades after one was last seen there. Stephanie Hegarty reports.
The elusive spotty wildcat was photographed by a hidden camera while roaming the park at night, and it has taken conservationists by surprise. There's been no sign of a leopard in this part of the country since the 80s. Though it's not clear yet whether it's male or female, the animal looks healthy and well-fed. Park managers say the likelihood there are more is very high. This encouraging discovery is part of an ongoing effort by the state government in Bauchi to protect the park from poachers.
The former American boxer Jake LaMotta, known by his nickname Raging Bull, has died. He was in his late 90s, and US media say he fell ill with pneumonia in a nursing home. LaMotta's fame was bolstered by the 1980 movie Raging Bull, in which his vicious fighting methods and turbulent lifestyle were portrayed in an Oscar-winning performance by Robert De Niro. BBC News.
True Endeavours presents The Reverend Horton Heat with Fishbone, Strung Out and Los Kung Fu Monkeys at the Barrymore Theatre on Thursday, September 28th. The Reverend Horton Heat is the evangelical rock and roll stage persona of Jim Heath. For 25 years, Heath and bassist Jimbo Wallace have been preaching the psychobilly gospel. Also celebrating 25-plus groundbreaking years is Fishbone, who have never stopped blazing a trail of ska, funk, punk, rock fusion, and so-called black rock. Strung Out are a tech-punk quintet from California, and Los Kung Fu Monkeys are a ska-punk band based out of Canada and Mexico. True Endeavors presents The Reverend Horton Heat with Fishbone, Strung Out, and Los Kung Fu Monkeys on Thursday, September 28th at the Barrett. Keeping the rock flowing for over 40 years, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions.
All right. Look, I hope y'all ready, because this conversation has already started before we got online today. This is going to be a good conversation. Let's see if I can get in the word in edgewise. We have some great guests. We thank you for joining us. This is Lalaita G. I'm your Wednesday host of A Public Affair. And I'm here each Wednesday at noon. And during the month of September, our theme has been Black to School. And we've been looking at the various levels of education and educational experiences for our Black kids from early education through college. And today, our topic is, does the Madison Metropolitan School District Board represent all students? And I'm looking forward to a very candid conversation with Ali Muldrow and Wayne Strong, two former candidates for the Madison Metropolitan School District, both former candidates, both still Black though. Yeah, keeping hope alive. And both, unfortunately, who did not win their races. Ali Muldrow, who ran for the school board in 2017, is the racial justice youth organizer for GSAFE. Ali, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you here. And Wayne Strong, who ran for the Madison School District School Board in 2013 and 2014. Could not catch a break. Was a Madison police officer for more than 20 years. Who better would you want on the school board but a police officer? He is now the Director of Workforce Management for the Urban League. Wayne, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So if you're listening today and you would like to join the conversation, it's going to be good. Please give us a call here at 608-256-2001. We'd love to have your comments or your questions. I'm going to have to take off my shoes for this discussion just in case. I have to get up out of here right quick. I don't know. It's going to be good. So, you know, Ali asked me, you know, why did I want to talk about this topic? You know, I have two adult children, both of whom went both to private school and public school here in Madison. I am a product of Madison Public Schools, started at Lapham as a four-year-old in kindergarten, all the way through Leopold, Lincoln, and then I went to West High School. And so as someone who both has raised children, been raised in this community, and I find myself being an advocate for our kids who are still in the school districts around this community, I feel very strongly for our kids and for what I see. I see a lot in classrooms, on the playgrounds, in the offices. I see a lot of things. And lot of concern there. And so I think it's an important conversation to have around this issue. And, you know, I'm specifically talking about Madison Metropolitan School District, but I really think this is a broader conversation for Dane County, really. And so we can plug that in as well. And so let me just start off with asking you all, you know, what inspired you to run, Ali?
Well, I'm also a product of the Madison Public Schools. I went to kindergarten through graduation in school in Madison, and you know, back when kindergarten was half days. And I graduated at a time when 38% of African American students were graduating, and that is really what launched my interest in education, was watching my classmates, my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, end up incarcerated and end up dropping out and being, you know, completely disengaged by their education. And when I first got into education, I really wanted to make sure young folks had access to the opportunities that had allowed me to be successful. So I started doing the things that had allowed me to be successful. I started, you know, hosting spoken word. I started, you know, volunteering in after school programs. And I realized that what had made me successful at school was a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And that kids didn't need what I needed. You know, they didn't need the services that I needed. They needed services that were specific to them and that spoke to them. And I, you know, the longer I've worked in education, the more I have wanted to transform education. And I told myself this last year that I had to stop waiting for the leadership that, you know, I thought could change the mm-hmm. schools and be that leadership.
We've waited for a long time as a people for a lot of things. It does get tiring. Wayne, what inspired you to run?
Well, there were many things. First of all, I'm a product of the public school system. I grew up in Racine in a single parent family. So I always knew that education was important. And my mom always stressed that with me, and she always encouraged me to do my best. And so I was fortunate to be someone who was able to graduate from high school, go on to college, get a degree, and I feel very fortunate mm-hmm. that I was able to do that. My kids are products of this school district. They both graduated in 05 and 07 from La Follette. They've both gone on to college and graduated from there and are living their lives now and doing well. And then, as I said, growing up in Racine, for me, in a single-parent family, growing up in you know, in a low-income family, I always knew that the way for me to escape poverty was education. That mm-hmm. is really the only way to break the cycle of poverty. And so, growing up and seeing all of the you know, what was happening in Racine in terms of the economy and everything, I knew that getting an education was going to be important for me to be successful in life. And so that really drove me. Mm-hmm. And so coming here to Madison, moving here in 1989, and raising my kids here, as I said, they grew up in the district. I saw a lot of things that concerned me, and, mm-hmm. and much of what concerned me back in the mid-90s were this pattern that I saw in terms of the disparity in terms of mm-hmm. in terms of graduation rates of suspensions, rates of expulsions, mm-hmm. truancy, everything. I saw that African-American children were leading in all of those categories, and mm-hmm. I thought we need to do something to change this. And so that was what prompted me to run. And also at the time, I was in law enforcement, and I felt and still feel very strongly that keeping our schools safe is important. So those are basically mm-hmm. the two platforms I ran on. One was the achievement gap, closing mm-hmm. the achievement gap, reducing the racial disparities in terms of all the things I just mentioned earlier, and safe schools.
And, you know, as I said, I started at Lapham. I'm going to date myself and age myself probably in 1971. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, throughout my experience in the early 70s, throughout the early 80s in the Madison School District, that we've gone, I feel like, from goodish to worse. You know, a lot of times you see and hope for the progression of a community that, you know, that things get better over time, that we learn and we grow. And I feel like we have gone backwards in Madison. The type of experiences that I had, and I would say, for the most part, I had really great experiences in Madison School District in terms of, you know, feeling like it was a place that was mostly acceptable. And understand, I went in the early 70s. So the numbers that of students who look like me is vastly different and multiplied now. And I have found that the greater numbers does not call necessarily for greater compassion for diversity. And I often feel that because there were fewer numbers in the 70s, that white people felt a lot more comfortable in number and therefore were afforded to be more magnanimous than they are now, because it was a curious thing. You know, when I was 4 years old in kindergarten, I was invited over one of my friend's houses who lived in Lakewood Gardens in a mansion. You know, a doggone limousine came and picked me up. You know, I was different. I was the only black girl in my class, you know, and I just feel like the tolerance has changed. You know, even though I hate that word, tolerance, has really changed. And so as we look at the current school board, and I'm going to jump around a little bit because I want to get into a little bit of that conversation we're having before we went on air. We look at the current school board. It consists of one black male, four white women, and a total of three men right now. And we were talking about James Howard, who is the current president of the school board. And I was just mentioning the fact that I don't know who he is. And I'm a lifelong Madison resident. I know most black people have heard of them and, you know, get a sense of what they've done. And this is not a negative thing. I'm just saying I had no idea who he was. And we were talking a little bit about that. Let's jump back into that conversation.
Yeah, so I think what we had kind of discussed was when you are known in Madison for bringing a racial justice lens to the community, especially when you're known, you know, in the black community for working in collaboration with other black people. I think this was true for Everett Mitchell when he ran, mm-hmm. is that it's used against you. Mm-hmm. You know, your connection to YGB is used against you. Your mm-hmm. connection, you know, being an amplified voice in the interests of communities of color is something that folks are really resistant to. And so I think that James Howard, you know, the difference between us and James Howard is that James Howard got elected, mm-hmm. you know, and he got elected because he's strategic and intentional and does the work of really making sure that he isn't alienating anybody. But I think that that is a tremendous balancing act, mm-hmm. you know, and a level of restraint that I admire deeply, but can't aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I concur with that. And I do think that James has done an extraordinary job. But, you know, it's very difficult as one person to affect the kind of change that we need. And if you're one person on the school board and you're the mm-hmm. only person who has this opinion, or you have, you know, these thoughts about certain issues, if you're the only one, you're not going to get much traction there. So I think, you know, it's important to be able to build coalitions. And I think James, to some extent, has been able to do that. But I think there's much larger systemic issues that are outside the school board. And much of the things that I see that are really problematic for us in terms of a community is that we need to continue to address the more systemic issues in our society. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that poverty is the reason why our kids are succeeding, because that's an absolute fallacy.
Right.
Poverty
absolutely.
Is not the reason that our kids are succeeding.
Can you pause there for a moment?
Absolutely.
And let that sink in, because people want to say, we've been poor a long time.
Yeah, oh, precisely.
And that's never stopped us
never.
From reaching for the stars.
Never. But you hear that as a frequent justification by mm-hmm. some who will say, well, it's these kids are poor. They
right.
can't. Nothing could be further from the truth. As I said, I grew up in a single parent family. We mm-hmm. were poor. I was able to learn enough mm-hmm. to go to college. And I feel like if I was able to do that, anybody can do it.
Right.
But you have to have a certain fortitude about yourself. And I think you need to be given early on an incentive. And it's important to have good role models. And that's one of the things that with the Southside Raiders, for example, we work with a group of young kids, grades 3 through 8, to really try to hone that in on them, that it's important for you to get good grades in school. Playing football is one thing, but if you don't get good grades in school, this mm-hmm. is all for naught. You can be the best athlete out
right.
there, but if you're not getting good grades, that's right. not going to serve you well, because when it comes to college and to SAT and ACT scores, that's where the rubber meets the road. So you really need to be performing in the classroom. And this is a mindset that is so difficult to penetrate. And I'll just give one quick example. I was talking with an acquaintance a few weeks ago about his son, an incredibly gifted athlete. This kid is definitely gifted,
mm-hmm.
a football player, extraordinary kid. the dad said to me that, well, I don't want my kid to go to a high school where the academics are too stringent because I really want him to be able to focus on his athletics. And I said, after listening for a while and biting my tongue, I said, well, you really want your son to go to a school where the academics are stringent, mm-hmm. where he's going to be pushed into classroom, where he's going to be, encouraged to live up to his expectations. Mm-hmm. And so if that's not the case, then regardless of how gifted he is athletically, that, again, is going to be off or not. Because if he can't get into a decent college, his chances of doing anything else, in terms of athletics at least, is pretty much, out the window. So we really need to focus more on the academic part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we try to do with our young kids with the Southside Raiders. We really preach them the importance of education, staying out of trouble, staying out of gangs, and getting good grades and staying in school so that they can go on and compete at the high school and hopefully the college and even professional level.
Right. I because I know we've heard too many stories, we all have, about students who are graduating who cannot read,
yeah.
who are making it into college who cannot read,
yeah.
you know, and if you by chance get picked, you know, it's NFL, NBA is like a lottery system, really, you know, but you're not able to do anything after that. It's a short-lived career, no matter
Absolutely.
How good you are.
Absolutely.
So let me throw this out here. And Ali, you were talking about how that balancing act is very difficult for Black people in particular who are trying to not alienate folks but try to build coalitions. But it usually does not tip in our favor, that whole balancing act. We usually are on the losing end. And being a person who is not very politically correct, I will say that I'm tired of looking at photographs of entities of leadership and seeing nothing but almost white women smiling back at me. I'm tired of that. So I went and I looked at the school board. You know, half of them are white women. You know,
no, they're the majority. The majority of the school board right now is white women.
Absolutely. And then when I looked up the fact that Ms. Malele, in 1973, she was the first Black person mm-hmm. elected to the board. And then someone had told me about a Mary Wilborn. And I looked up some papers and I saw that there was some document with her name on it in the late 70s, 77, 78. Mm-hmm. So by my estimation, you know, it's been 40 years since we've had a Black woman on the school board in Madison. And as we continue to hear stories about what's going on with our Black kids, we know that a majority of our children are being raised by single parent households by Black women, mm-hmm. you know. But every time a Black woman runs for the school board, she can't seem to win. So mm-hmm. on one hand, we're saying Black parents need to get more involved. And then when Black parents are trying to get more involved at the highest level of the school district, they can't catch a break.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, I think the great thing about me running for school board, or the great thing about Nichelle, really, mm-hmm. the great thing about Nichelle running for school board and Ananda running for school board is mm-hmm. that I didn't want to run for school board. I didn't think about myself that way. I'm not mm-hmm. I wasn't a kid who was positioned to think of myself as somebody who was going to go on to be successful or be in a position of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was when you know, I was given kind of the job opportunities that somebody like me should have. When mm-hmm. I looked around my community, I was told, you know, be an assistant nurse, be a CNA, or be an assistant teacher. But the idea of me as the main character, as the leader, as the elected official, it was something that I had, mm-hmm. hadn't been exposed to,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so when Nichelle ran, it was eye-opening for me. And mm-hmm. legitimately, Nichelle's data is part of what my candidacy was based on, was looking at the people who voted for Nichelle and voted mm-hmm. for you know, someone like her,
mm-hmm.
And using that information to empower my leadership. So one of my biggest hopes in running was that other women, particularly other young women of color,
mm-hmm.
would see me and you know, find my email and say, how'd you do what you did? How were you successful in the areas that you were successful? And if you could go back and change things, what would you change? And take that information and run with it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I think they're, you know, the most fantastic part of running for me was when I would have students come up to me and say, oh, I didn't realize that somebody you just know could run for office,
cool.
you know, to be able to tell my students, I filled out two pieces of paper and got 200 signatures.
Wow.
And now I'm running for office. Mm-hmm. You know, I opened a bank account. You mm-hmm. know, it's not what you make it out to be. Mm-hmm. And what I'll say is when I decided to run, you know, the voices that got the loudest in my own head were the ones that said, you can't do this or you're not enough. Mm-hmm. And I really had to silence those voices. I had to silence the part of myself that still felt inferior. Mm-hmm. And say my experiences are relevant mm-hmm. to the problems that define our community right now.
Yes. Great point. So the mission of the school board is every school will be a thriving school that prepares every student to graduate from high school, college, career, and community ready. What are your thoughts when you hear that, Wayne? Warm and fuzzy, or do your eyes roll in the back of your head?
I think it's a good mission statement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's certainly something that I'm certain that every school in the district tries to live up to. But the reality is, you know, we're not there yet. And again, you know, I have to go back and look at the data because, you know, the data is telling us, you know, we've got a group of kids in our district that are not doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And so are we doing everything that we can possibly do as a district, as a community, to make certain that these kids are successful? And I think that some of the things that we've done, perhaps in terms of trying to reduce the number of suspensions and trying to increase graduation rates, to some extent have worked a little bit, but we're still woefully behind, especially mm-hmm. when it comes to graduation rates for African American students.
Absolutely.
We're still woefully behind. So we've got a lot of work to do yet. And so keeping the glass half full, mm-hmm. I think that that we need to continue along the lines of making sure that our kids are getting the best quality education they can get. And I think along with that, I think one thing the district really needs to really focus on, and I would say this, is that we need to increase our pool of black teachers, black and brown teachers in this mm-hmm. district. Kids need to see people who look like them.
Absolutely.
And when that and all of the data, all of the studies and the surveys all show that kids who have teachers who look like them during the earlier grades are much more successful mm-hmm. in school than those who do not.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, that's very compelling. And we need to do a better job of attracting teachers of color in this mm-hmm. district. And I don't think we've done that. I mean, just a case in point, I know personally of several black graduates of this district mm-hmm. that have gone into education, but they're not here. They're not in our district. They're elsewhere. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, in every other school district except Madison. So I think we need to, you know, we talk about, you know, growing our own or the homegrown talent. We've got it here. Mm-hmm. We're just not, for some reason, we're not attracting those candidates, and we've got to do a better job of doing that.
Ellie?
I think when you're talking about college and career readiness, I think that you are selling rhetoric that is no longer relevant mm-hmm. to our students, and they know it's not relevant to them. Going to school so that you can go to college, so that you can have a career, that's not why you go to school. If you look at you know, some of the most, you know, the meccas of academia in our community. Mm-hmm. You don't go to Harvard because you want to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're supposed to be cultivating the genius of our children, the originality of our children, the brilliance of our children. We're not supposed to be shaping them so that they can prescribe to the lives we think would be best for them.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to be empowering our children to pursue their dreams.
Yes.
You know? And so when we're talking about something like a cell phone ban, right? This is an area where I disagree with a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody was like, we're going to ban Snapchat. What do they need Snapchat for at school? You know, unless they're going to be a graphic designer, unless they're interested in computer science, unless they want to build apps.
No, I'm going to have to agree with that Snapchat.
Steven Spielberg had access to high-quality film equipment as a child and mm-hmm. went on to become an amazing director. When is the last time our district produced a Steven Spielberg? I'll wait.
We had to pause for that.
Every single kid has technology mm-hmm. in their hands that, you know, he couldn't have dreamed of mm-hmm. as a child. Absolutely. Why aren't we empowering our students to be at the forefront of advancing that technology? Why aren't we empowering our students to use that technology to tell their stories in ways that are meaningful and reach millions of people? Why aren't we, you know, why aren't we embracing fully the creativity of our young people? The bell system that we use in our schools, mm-hmm. that comes from a factory model that does right. not exist. Sitting, right. I don't want my child to be great at sitting in a desk mm-hmm. and staring at a computer screen. I don't need that for them unless that's what they really want to be doing.
Right.
You know?
I mean, our whole school system is set up on a factory-based model. The whole vision of the school system as a public institution was to prepare these kids to grow up to be good factory workers.
Right, to participate in an economy that does not exist. Mm-hmm. We are living in the information age. That's mm-hmm. that's what we live in right now. That should be, you know, we should all be overwhelmingly excited by the potential of what we can do. You know, you look back, me as an organizer, I look back at somebody like Bayard Rustin, and I think mm-hmm. you organized the March for Jobs and Freedom, the March on Washington. Mm-hmm. You didn't have text message. You didn't have email. Right. You didn't have any of that, right? You didn't have any of those tools, exactly. and you were right. able to yep. organize right. hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. And we should be able to look back at that and look at all of the access we have to information and communication mm-hmm. and go, well, we can't be stopped right now. Mm-hmm. And that's part that, you know, that's part of the reason I'm interested in the advancement of education mm-hmm. is really, I think, our goals are skewed, you know, towards the past in terms of education. And when you talk right. about data, let's just be real. A black man with a bachelor's degree is less likely to get a job than a white man with a felony. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think that young people of color in our schools realize that they're being set up to fail, you're underestimating the sophistication of our students. Our students are right. not failing. They are not being served. They know they're not being served, and they refuse to participate in something that isn't serving them. When you test a student and it says, oh, they read at a third grade level, I know that test is about how they feel about the test, because I know the majority of eighth graders, black eighth graders in Madison, are on Facebook, on Snapchat, on a series of platforms in which you have to be literate to mm-hmm. navigate that platform. You can't hand a cell phone to my 7-year-old, you know, who can read to a certain extent, and her know how to just navigate it. Mm-hmm. So tell me, how is that 13-year-old reading articles and posting statuses and reflecting on their life and communicating with their friends in text message if yeah. they don't have the ability to navigate literacy? They absolutely have that ability, but they're not going to apply that ability to a test or a school that doesn't have their best interests at heart, and yeah. they can feel that.
So let me say, if you're just joining us, this is a public affair. I'm Aleta G, your host, and we're talking with Ali Muldrow and Wayne Strong, two previous candidates for the Madison Metropolitan School District Board, and we're talking about, does the current board serve all children? And, you know, there's two things I want to bring up. Last week, we had the Justice family in the studio who homeschool their beautiful kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were talking a lot about what you're talking about, tying into that individuality, those gifts, those talents, the way they are being bent naturally and nurturing that. And I would that our schools did that for all students. And I hear a lot about people saying, you know, schools are trying and we're doing. And I just wonder sometimes, like, what does try mean? You know what I mean? I didn't try to get dressed this morning. I got dressed this mm-hmm. morning. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm just wondering, at some point, how much leniency do we give, and how many more kids do we lose in the process as we're waiting for this equity and people to diversify and love all kids and believe in all kids?
I don't know that we'll ever reach equity. I don't know. I think that we need to continue to make progress. And when I think about college and career readiness, I think about not just college. When I was growing up back in the 70s, graduating from high school, it was all about college, right? That was mm-hmm. really your only option. It was college or military, or go get a job at, you know, A.O. Smith or mm-hmm. some factory. But, you know, there are a lot of other career choices out there too, in terms of career paths that kids can take. And I think, you know, we don't give kids enough choices. There are more choices than going to college. Not every kid is college material. Not every kid wants to go to college.
Mm-hmm. We do a lot of college shaming.
But we do. And we certainly need to keep that open for kids as an option, to let them know, hey, right, you know, if you want to go to college, we can certainly help prepare you for that. But if a kid doesn't want to go to college and they want to get a career as a plumber or an electrician or something like that, we need to make sure that kids know that there are other jobs out there that they can get that, one, they will not incur a lot of debt to get, mm-hmm, and two, they'll be able to have self-sustaining wages that they can use to support themselves and their family. And giving kids those other options is critical. I was always a big person on college. I made sure that my kids went to college. That was important for me to have them get those college degrees. Mm-hmm. But for every kid, that's not a reality. And so we need to make sure that we're giving kids the other choices that they need.
It's absolutely unacceptable to have African-American students not being served by their schools. Mm-hmm. That is not something that we can go, oh, maybe next year we're going to, mm-hmm, decide that we want to teach young children of color to read. Mm-hmm. It's completely inappropriate. We cannot spend $500 million a year to produce the nation's largest achievement gap. Mm-hmm. You know, what the achievement gap describes is not that if you're living in poverty, you're gonna have lesser opportunities in our district. Because we know if you're white and you live in poverty, you're going to be all right. Mm-hmm. You know, the stereotyping of black children's homes, mm-hmm, is a problem, mm-hmm, right? Because white families get divorced or split up, right, just as frequently.
Absolutely.
Have just as many blended families.
Absolutely.
So white families live in poverty too, and their, right, kids are still have a 90% shot of graduating. Mm-hmm. What the achievement gap describes is that the color of a child's skin is an indicator of how well they will be served in our schools. And we have to hold people accountable. And I know that that is what people are the most afraid of, mm-hmm, is the most afraid of saying this racism, you know, doesn't grow on trees. It's not just happening. Mm-hmm. It's a system that was created and maintained. And because it was created and because it is being maintained, it can be stopped. But it, mm-hmm, can't be stopped by saying little by little, you know, little by little, right, we're going to change, or we're going
to
pilot at this school.
We need to be radical at this point.
We need to demand. We can't ask for change. We need, mm-hmm, to demand change. We need to demand that when our children go into their schools, that they are supported, that they are celebrated, that they are seen for more than their mistakes. Mm-hmm. That they have curriculum that is engaging to them, that they, you know, I think oftentimes we frame working with students of color or working with students with disabilities as extra help. We're, mm-hmm, not giving them extra help. We are giving them appropriate services. You know, so disservicing black students is something we as a community need to be accountable for. And, mm-hmm, to the credit of James Howard, he pushed very hard recently. You know, he said we all have to take responsibility. We have not gotten it right when it comes to black students. Mm-hmm. And at some point, we all have to admit we're a part of getting it wrong.
Yeah.
I think the time is now.
So how do we roll in the whole idea of expectation? Because if you have a 5-year-old child who's entering the school district, one's name is Dakota and one's name is Tyrone. I mean, at some point, do we not believe that Dakota and Tyrone have the same intellectual ability to, yeah, be educated?
Yeah.
And if we believe that, then the question isn't what's wrong with the kids, it's what's wrong with the system.
And that's a huge piece of that. And so what we know is that kids achieve at the level they're expected to achieve. Mm-hmm. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you've got a teacher who believes in you, who believes that you can learn, who genuinely cares about your well-being, is connected with you in that way, mm-hmm, that makes all the difference in the world to kids.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, if you've got teachers or staff who have this mentality that, well, because this kid lives in this zip code or that zip code, mm-hmm, they live in Allied Drive or Dobber Worthington, they're from a poor family, you know, we'll just do what we can with them. That doesn't serve our kids well. And I think to Allie's point, that's exactly right. Those are the kinds of teachers that we know, mm-hmm, are systematically failing our kids. There has to be a better way of tracking and evaluating that sort of thing, because I don't care what color the teacher is or who they are. If you're not there for the students, you shouldn't be there. And we need to make sure that we're hiring teachers that, one, care for students, have a love for students, and two, we need to diversify our teaching pool, because, again, that is is largely reflective of why so many of our kids, I think, have not connected with teachers and haven't gone on to high school because they've dropped out or whatever, or you know, was kicked out, missed so many days of school that they're so far behind in graduating that now they're not going to graduate.
Right.
Those are the things that are holding our kids back, and those are the things we need to address.
So historically,
yeah.
Okay, so let's look back prior to the desegregation of schools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I've had this conversation with people. I think the desegregation of schools was the worst thing that happened to Black students.
Yeah.
Because the issues that we're having, that we're talking about today, the disparities were not present in these schools that had Black teachers,
right.
Black principals,
right.
Black janitors, and Blackness of everything.
And these were poor schools, too.
These were poor schools, and they produced doctors and
yep.
lawyers and politicians.
Yep.
Why? What's the difference? Those teachers and administrators love those children,
mm-hmm.
and you best believe that they held them to a high level of
That's right.
expectation,
That's right.
right?
That's right.
So when we're talking about then increasing our level of expectation for teachers, do we worry that there is a conflict of interest for two of the board members who are married to district employees who are both also members of the teachers union? Are we concerned about that?
So I'm wearing the MTI hoodie. My partner is an educator, an MMSD. And I think, you know, the conflict of interest that kind of was a large part of the conversation around my candidacy was, you know, to me was an interesting way of sensationalizing a local school board race. You know, Donald Trump's conflicts of interest around him being able to profit from his own security staff
mm-hmm.
staying, you know, in Trump Tower is very different than a school board member advocating that we should value the people we employ
mm-hmm.
as a district. I want the representatives of our school board to value our educators. I want them to value our students. I don't think we need to pit educators and students against each other.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Definitely,
you know?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot about that is really, you know, interesting in terms of the attention span of our community.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the questions I got were really questions about how we on the local level would respond to somebody like DeVos,
mm-hmm.
you know, questions about vouchers, questions about private charters, questions that are not specific to the work of the Madison Public School District,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so I think we have to really, we have to understand what, you know, why we're interested in something at a specific time. You know, TJ Mertz, whose partner works for the school district, has been on the school board for quite some time. And this hasn't been an issue that was talked about. The same is true for Anna Moffitt. And I think a lot of folks felt like the reason it was brought up around me and my candidacy was that it was an easy excuse and a way to avoid talking about, you know, race,
mm-hmm.
you know, is to say Ali has this conflict of interest that hinders her from being able to work in the interests of educators.
Mm-hmm.
But they really meant was not your partner, but your skin color.
Right. But what I really think is that it was part of a sensationalized narrative that connected my candidacy to the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we want to talk about right now is a conflict of interest anywhere. And I'm like, yo, y'all, we should probably focus on a conflict of interest that's resulting in, you know, the president of the United States profiting.
Right.
You know, which is very different than somebody saying, I have to recuse myself from this particular item, you know, or this element of the budget because my family could benefit from the decision made.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, you know, the conflicts of interest are common on the school board,
mm-hmm.
and I think the school board in general navigates conflicts of interest with a great deal of transparency, you know.
Okay. So now, what do you all think is going on with the rate of suspension, particularly for Black girls? Wayne?
Yes.
Well,
talk.
Yeah, I mean, boy, this has been an issue for a long time. This is not a new issue for us, and I think, you know, even going back to the 90s, I remember when I was one of the part-time EROs at West High School, we saw this with our Black girls. You know, they you know, were these groups of girls that were beating each other up, and some of it was tied to boys, some of it was sort of, you know, gang-related. But there clearly is a need, I think, for us to step up as a community in terms of providing greater mentorship and greater support for African-American girls, because I think that is something that is definitely lacking. Mm-hmm. And I know that there have been a lot of efforts to try to increase that. And the violence and that's happening is certainly something that we don't want to see continue. But I have to go back to what's happening with these children in their home lives. I think a lot of it does that. And when I hear teachers, I just heard a teacher say this the other day, that, well, you know, they don't have the time to be concerned about what's happening with the kid at home. But what's happening with the kid at home is largely reflective of what happens to the kid at school and in society at large. So we have to address what's happening with these kids in their home lives. Kids going home to a lot that are dealing with food security issues, with housing issues. A lot of kids are facing homelessness, that sort of thing. So kids are dealing with kids have trauma. You know, they're dealing with a whole host of issues that they bring to school. And of course, the teacher is not prepared to deal with that. They can't deal with the trauma that a kid has faced from being sexually assaulted or for being, you know, brutalized in some way. Right. But those are the kinds of things that I think have a tendency to sort of drive up these numbers in terms of saying, you know, witnessing the incidents that we're seeing with you know, the fighting with the girls and the violence. So I think we need to do a better job of, again, reaching more systemic issues in terms of trying to find out what's the source of the anger, what's the source of the frustration that's leading to these encounters in the schools.
Ellie?
I think that when you talk about what the students are doing to get suspended, you automatically make suspension and expulsion the responsibility of the students. I think schoolyard fights have existed and will continue to exist. I think the fact that we overemphasize conflict when Black women are in positions of conflict is something that follows us throughout our entire lives.
Amen, sister.
I can be having a conversation. I can be typing to somebody on Facebook and all of a sudden I'm angry or I'm hostile or I'm attacking them. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I just wrote three sentences to you. Right. You are fine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You are at home looking at your phone. You are okay. Like, I do not
safe.
Hurt you. Right? The majority of the reasons that our children, the number one reason for in-school suspension in our district is dishonesty. The number one reason for being arrested in our school district is disorderly conduct. The number two is resisting arrest. Our children are not out here running around assaulting people. Mm-hmm. Young Black women are not, you know, they are not the violence we need to be concerned about. If we're concerned about violence, then we need to be talking about young white men on campus and sexual assaults. If we're worried about violence, if we're worried about violating
people,
now. Let's just not pretend that this is a coincidence. This is America. This country was founded on the idea that Black people are intellectually inferior.
Right.
It was founded on the idea that we are going to make it illegal for certain people's children to learn how to read, that certain people's children are not fit for freedom.
Right.
You know, slavery was perpetrated against Black children. It was birthed to death. You were born into it. So it's not a coincidence that we are more interested in blaming Black children or finding out what they do wrong. My daughter was in 4K and she was getting in trouble for things like getting in line too fast, getting in line too slow, going to the bathroom without asking. Her teacher was describing her as difficult and hyper. You know, she was a baby, my baby, you know. So I think, you know, when we're talking, I am a young Black woman. I grew up in this community. I'm connected to other Black women. And I think this stereotype of us as hostile and violent and deserving of suspension and expulsion, I think it's a false narrative. I don't think we're suspending Black children more frequently because they deserve it. I think we are suspending more Black children more frequently because it confirms that they don't deserve an education, that we don't have to focus on teaching them because we can focus on their behavior. It allows white people in this community over and over again to light fires and take credit for putting them out.
I'm about to take, I already took off my shoe. I'm about to throw it at you, girl. You know, it's just like, you can see time and time again, and I don't want to go off on this topic, but time and time again, you can see police officers who have shot unarmed Black men, and they get off time and time and time and time again. Mm-hmm. Because their justification is, I feared for my life. They mm-hmm. know the language to use. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a weapon. I thought all of these things that they can use to justify that. They never have to say it was because of a black person. But now then you see this officer who just says, well, you know, we only shoot unarmed black people. And he's immediately fired. Yeah. I can kill you and not be fired. I can say something racist and immediately be fired. Why? Because whenever you bring in race as the issue, mm-hmm. then black white people want to back up, because the worst thing you could ever call a white person is a racist.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we say achievement gap instead of discrimination.
Right.
Our children are being suspended and expelled because they are being discriminated against yes. in school. Not because they're bad, not because they deserve it. They're being targeted in school for discipline because this country and this community have a history of discriminating against and devaluing people of color.
Yes.
And when you look at the suspension data, I just looked at it on Wise Dash this morning before I came here. So from the 2011-2012 academic school year up through last year, 2015-2016, which is the most recent data, the numbers for suspension for African-American children were going down. But they're still in the double digits and still twice as high as most of the other racial ethnic groups. So we still haven't addressed the issue of, while the numbers are coming down, why are our kids still getting suspended at, you know, double digit rates? Those are questions we still need to answer yet. And I don't think we're there.
And I think the other issue is that suspension is one thing, and it's a very important issue. But if you hang out in some of these schools, I think we also need to be looking at kids who are out of class, mm-hmm. who don't get entered into the data,
right.
and they're still not learning.
Yeah.
Right. Our kids are being disproportionately targeted for being sent out of class. Mm-hmm. They're being disproportionately targeted for restraint and seclusion. Yep. They're being disproportionately placed in special education. Mm-hmm. And for every area in which something is disproportionately children of color living in poverty, mm-hmm. there is an area in which it is disproportionately white affluent children, mm-hmm. right? So when you're looking at our ski clubs, when you're looking at our theater programming, when you're looking at our study abroad opportunities, mm-hmm. when you're looking at, you know, who gets to get their license in high mm-hmm. school,
right?
Like, right. you know, if we were opening those doors to our students, when you were saying when I went to school here, I felt like things were actually better than they are right now. Mm-hmm. I look at East when I went to school and now that my sister is going to school there, and I go, man, she doesn't have access to some of the opportunities I had
Absolutely.
Access to. Because right. I had a theater professor who was doing Raisin in the Sun, because I had Milt McPike as my principal. Mm-hmm. I had Richard Scott as mm-hmm. as the minority student coordinator. I had a support system of folks of color who were prioritizing me. I had Katie Jones at East, who, when we started talking about African-American women not doing as well as school, she worked together with Richard Scott to create a retreat for black women to come together and to communicate with one another and to be in community with one another, to encourage each other's leaderships. You know, those sorts of opportunities mm-hmm. really defined my access to an education. And I don't see those opportunities available to my younger sister who's going to the same school I went to.
I absolutely agree. But I think the other point I want to make is that our kids are in the office and they're not in class. Mm. And we're not seeing those numbers because they're not being added into the suspension numbers, because right. they're not being suspended, but they're not in class. And so, you know,
But let me just say that data is tracked, though, and you can find that on the Wise Dash. I'm pretty sure I saw that there was a category in there for out of classroom time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that data is out there.
So it's important for us to look at that data as well, because suspension is more of a sensationalized thing, and it's important, it's crucial.
Right.
But we need to be looking at when they're out of class, when they're in school, because parents are not always being called.
True. Well, and even when you're in class, you're not in class. Because when we talk about right. integration, when you're integrating a school, that would mean you would integrate the faculty, mm-hmm. right? It would be
and the curriculum.
And the curriculum, right?
right? So I can be sitting in a class, and when I'm reading, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the only character that looks like me is the mammy, mm-hmm. I'm not having the same experience as a young white man in that class who gets to identify with Atticus and gets to yes. identify, you know, who gets to identify with Scout. When you are a young white man in our schools, you get to be the author of the book and the main character in the book and the artist and the mathematician and the scientist. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any of that mm-hmm. in the curriculum for somebody like me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. Absolutely. And it makes a huge difference. It really does. It was telling somebody the story recently when I was in third grade at Leopold and they were teaching us about slavery. They taught it very much like they taught it in the 70s. Abraham Lincoln was the great white hope. And so at recess, some little white girls came over to me and told me how I should be grateful to them. And I'm like, why? Because we freed you from slavery. Now that just shows you how they heard that lesson, mm-hmm. right? That they were the heroines.
Well, I mean, that's the entire way we frame slavery is as if slavery is the history of black people. And I'm like, that's like if I punched you in the face and mm-hmm. said, you got a history of getting punched in the face. You would say, no, Ali, you have a history of punching people. What is, you know, slavery doesn't tell me anything yeah. about black people, but it tells us a lot about the white community.
Hush, girl. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So when we talk about a safe learning environment, mm-hmm. that seems buzzword for not fighting and things like that. But what is a safe learning environment for our black kids?
I think it's one where kids feel that they, you know, are safe and that they can learn in an environment where there's not a lot of distractions and you know, they feel safe within their persons. They feel, you know, that their property is safe, that their bodies are safe. And I think it's important from an academic standpoint that, you know, for our teachers to feel safe in the classroom and our students. I think that creates the best learning environment for everybody.
Ali?
I think safety, you know, for a lot of the young people I work with also means being protected. I think mm-hmm. if you're an LGBTQ student in our community, then knowing that there are policies and practices that, you know, make sure that you're not discriminated against, that make sure that nobody has the right to harass you in school are really important. I think for our African American students, I think safety means not just that there's a policy, but that also people are held accountable for working in your best interest. Mm-hmm. And so I think having a safe school is also about having a school that is brave enough to admit when they're doing something poorly and address it proactively and courageously.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I read in a statement that you wrote after your election, your campaign, that your intention was to go meet with each of the school board members and offer your support. How'd that go for you?
You know, I have worked with some school board members consistently for a long period of time, and mm-hmm. they are folks that I greatly admire and deeply appreciate. And mm-hmm. then there are folks on the board who just have very, very different priorities mm-hmm. in terms of education. And there are folks, you know, on the school board, I believe right now, who are really the guardians of the status quo, who are really the gatekeepers for doing it the way we've always done. And to a certain extent, you know, going back to the good old days, you know, mm-hmm. The good old days before Walker, the good old days before Trump. If you're black in America, there is no going back. There is only right. going forward.
There are no good old days.
and so, you know, I know people, you know, are thinking of Donald Trump and are thinking of Scott Walker as the folks who are defining this current reality. Right. We had the largest achievement gap in the country with Obama as the president. We had the largest achievement gap in the country with Clinton as president. You know, so the issues that we have, they are not a fashion statement of this current moment. These are systems that took centuries to create, and they will take lifetimes to deconstruct, and we need everybody to work with us to do it.
And there you go. All right, we're still live on Facebook. That was very powerful.
Explore. foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level.